Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Accidental Texan, a novel by Cole Thompson, narrated by J. Rodney Turner. The Beginning. 1. Even on a budget tour bus, he's an unusually gruesome passenger. Where his left eye should be is a big yellow rectum-like scar. And what few teeth he has are rotted to brown nubs. White beard stubble covers his cheek and neck. Greasy gray hair hangs from under his Dallas Cowboys cap. And his jacket, a navy blazer, is ridiculously long in the sleeves. He plops down beside me, looks at me with his bloodshot eye, and nods.
Hey, I'm Luther.
As I nod and introduce myself, his B.O. hits.
Yow.
I sit up and look over the lady's hair in front of me to find an empty seat. To my dismay, a horde of El Pasoans are filing up the aisle. There are no empty seats. Holy shit.
Where are you headed?
He asks. Boston. He slides his hand out of his sleeve and points to himself.
I'm going home, Bo. Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
He smiles a rotten tooth smile. Holy shit. As we set out from El Paso, I put on my Walkman, crank the FEMS, and look out the window into the darkness. Damn, I wish it wasn't dark. This was one of the few pluses of this whole trip, getting to see Texas. I think they shot Giant out here somewhere. Luther nudges my shoulder. I turn from the window and he holds up a deck of cards in the overhead light. I click off my Walkman. What? He jigs his eyebrows and smiles.
Game for a hand or two?
I shake my head. No, but thanks. He frowns.
Oh, what else we gonna do, Bo? Texas is a long ways across.
For some reason, he calls me Bo. I don't know why. It's not my name. I look at the cards and shake my head again. Sorry, Luther, but I'm just going to hang out if you don't mind. I punch my Walkman back on and look out the window. In the corner of my eye, I watch Luther produce a roll of cash from the inside breast pocket of his blazer. As he riffles through his roll, counting it, I see that Luther has quite a few $10 and $20 bills. I click off my Walkman. Are you wanting to play for money, Luther?
Heck yeah, Bo. Poker ain't poker if you ain't got money out there.
He shoves his money back in his jacket and shuffles the cards on his thigh. I have about $100, which is more than enough to last 3 days to Boston. So when I ask Luther what sort of stakes he has in mind, and he says $1 ante and $1 bets, with a pot limit of $10 per hand, I think, what the hell, I could use the extra cash. I take off my Walkman and stuff it in my backpack. Okay, Luther, let's play. He smiles.
Hey, Bo, you all right?
Beneath the dim overhead light, the other passengers dozing around us and the Texas night rolling by outside, Luther deals the cards. After about 30 hands, I want to scream and gouge out Luther's other eye. The son of a bitch bluffs. Hand after hand, he raises the bet past the point where I can reasonably stay. And after I fold, he smiles, buries his cards in the deck, and rakes the pot toward him. Given this is such a small-stakes game, several times after I fold and concede the pot, I show my cards and ask, "What did you have, really?"
"The meat can't peak," Luther says,
smiling his rotten three-teeth smile.
"The meat can't peak."
What an asshole. About 3 hours into the game, I get a whopper. A full house. 3 aces, 2 sevens. It's a cinch winner. But warming to the dramatics of the game, I hesitate as I bet $1. Luther calls my bet and takes up the deck.
"How many, Bo?"
With a show of head-scratching indecision, I indicate that I want no additional cards, but will stay with my original 5.
Well, looky here, Luther says. Bo gonna stay all the way. He picks up his hand and looks at it. Not I. I's head high in the shit sty. He discards four of his cards and draws four new ones. Upon seeing his new cards, his eye opens wide. He laughs and slaps his leg. I be goddamn. He takes a dollar from his pile and tosses it into the pot. I bet you a dollar on this one, Bo. I call Luther's bet. Then, chewing my lip and feigning reluctance, raise him a dollar. To my surprise, he calls my raise, and in turn, raises me a dollar. I know exactly what he's doing, but it won't work this time, not when I hold such a doozy. My condolences, Luther, but unfortunately, you can't bluff your way through this one. You show, Bo? Yes, I'm sure. Matching his raise. I put another dollar into the pot, taking it to its limit of $10. I start to lay down my cards, but Luther reaches up and stops me. Hang on, Bo. He carefully lays his cards face down on the seat between us. Maybe we should forget our pot limit and play this one big as we want. I look at my cards again to make sure I haven't misread them. No. It's definitely a full house, aces over sevens. I might agree to that, I say. How much do you want to bet? The bet's yours, Bo. I made the last raise. So you're saying on this particular hand, I can bet however much I want? Yes, sir. We play in New Orleans rules on this one. No limit. I sit back and perform a quick calculation. With aces as the group of three in my full house, it's impossible that Luther can beat me with a full house. He must, at the very least, have four of a kind. And since he discarded all his cards except one from his original hand, in order to have four of a kind, he would have at least had to draw three matching cards to go along with the one he held. I'm not exactly sure what the odds of that are, but I know they're ridiculous. Like about one in a million. Luther, I'll bet you $20. I take the money from my wallet and lay it in the pot. I'm sure such a beefy bet will snuff Luther's bluffing tactic, but instead he pulls his roll of money from his jacket. I'll see you, 20, Bo, and raise you 250. He places his roll of cash on the pile of money between us. My first instinct is to throw in my hand, accept the $30 loss, and quit the game altogether. But I'm sick of this moron, his ridiculous bluffing and haughty posturing. I remind myself this is a situation of numbers, cold facts. I rethink the odds. There's no fucking way. Luther, this stinking hick is bluffing. Like a gunshot, my resolve quickens. I take all my money from my wallet. I don't have 250 to call your bet, Luther. I only have 70 here. But I guarantee you my credit is good. He throws back his head and laughs, his three-teeth mouth open wide. Ain't no credit rolling on a bus, Bo. If you ain't tall enough to call, then that's all. He puts up his hand, indicating this is the end of the betting, then reaches toward the pot to gather up the money. I grab his hand. You liar. I know you're bluffing. You've been bluffing all night. He jerks his hand back and stares at me with his one eye. You really want to see my cards, Bo? Yes, I do. He looks down at the stack of money in my hand. How much money you got there? I told you, $70. All right, Bo, I'll draw down my bet to 70. And you put in your 70 and we'll just turn them over. Okay, it's a bet. He takes $180 from the pot, and I lay down all of my remaining money. Fo-fos, he says. He turns over his hand and fans out his cards. There they are, four fours. Staring in stunned disbelief, my head swimming with panic and outrage, I slam my hand down on the pile of money between us and close my fist around my stack of bills. Instantly, he grabs my wrist with one hand. With the other hand, from somewhere in the long, baggy sleeve of his blazer, he brings out a switchblade knife. Click. He flicks it open and presses the blade to my throat.
You let go of that money or I'll cut your fucking throat. I stare at his eye and release my grip on my money. Holding the knife to my throat, he wads together the money and stuffs it inside his jacket. He takes away the knife, folds it up, and slips it back into his long sleeve. No hard feelings, Bo, but don't ever fuck with my money. He licks his lips, leans back in his seat, and looks away. 2. The wind howls through the street, swinging the traffic lights in a loopy, yellow, blinking ballet. As the bus pulls away, a tumbleweed comes blowing down the sidewalk. Bounding and rolling in the wind, it bounces off my hip, then blows down the street beneath the swinging traffic lights, bounding and rolling. Light glows in the windows of a restaurant across the street. Several pickup trucks are parked in front under a red neon sign, Wildcat Cafe. Suitcase in one hand, backpack in the other. I duck my face from the blowing dust and walk across the street. It's not even dawn yet, but already a half dozen men sit at a big round table near the door, drinking coffee and talking in low mumbles. Some wear their cowboy hats. Others have set theirs on the table before them, revealing short, neatly oiled and combed gray hair. Their faces are tan and creased with wrinkles. They stare as I walk past. As I sit at the counter, I hear one say, "Got off the bus over here a while ago." A gum-chewing waitress stops behind the counter, sets a cup before me with a clatter, and fills it with steaming coffee. She lays a laminated menu on the counter, chews her gum, and winks. "Let me know when you're ready, doll." She walks away, leaving me with my coffee and chaos. On the bus, pissed off about losing all my money, not to mention having a switchblade shoved to my throat, I snatched down my suitcase and backpack and got off at the next stop, Abilene, Texas. I guess I could have just starved and rode it out penniless for 3 days to Boston. But hell, no way was I going to stay on the bus with that stinking one-eyed hick. But now what? Jesus, I don't even have a buck to pay for this coffee. Fuck. What else can I do? Guess I'll have to call home and ask Mom and Dad to wire some more money. God, Dad will go insane. All the stunts I've pulled lately and now this. Just the fact that he had to send me $400 to get out of L.A. was enough. I'll hear about that for the rest of my life anyway. And now I don't even make it halfway home. Holy shit. Oh well, maybe I'll say I was robbed. As I mull my situation, a lean, broad-shouldered guy in a cowboy hat walks up to the counter beside me. About 6 feet tall and a lanky 175 pounds, he wears gigantic tan cowboy boots, brown slacks, a belt with a silver and gold buckle, a long-sleeved white shirt, and snugly atop his head, a big, wide-brimmed straw cowboy hat. I do a double-take on his boots. They're huge, with massive tall heels and long, sharp toes. They must be real Texas cowboy boots. I'm the only customer seated at the counter. There are at least a dozen other empty stools, but he sits right beside me. He turns to me. Under his big hat brim, he has a handsome, sun-weathered face of about 45 years. His sky-blue eyes are large and searching. His nose is thin and long, and he has a deep crevice in his chin. He nods in a curt, earnest gesture. "Morning, son." "Good morning." "Morning, Merle," the waitress says. "Morning, Fay." "Looks like another windy one." "Yep, a little breezy." Fay puts a cup before Merle and fills it with coffee. "How's things?" she says. He pushes up the front brim of his hat with his index finger. "Oh, hell, Fay, I'm going broke hand over fist. And now on top of that, I'm so damn worked up about it, my love-making equipment's going bad on me." Fay frowns. "Well, honey, you shouldn't let yourself get all chewed up like that." A bell rings and a plate of steaming pancakes appears in the stainless steel service window behind Fay. She turns, snatches up the plate, and carries it away. "You're right, Faye," Merle says, though Faye is gone. "You're goddamn right." He reaches down, slips his hand into his huge, elaborately stitched boot, and brings out a flat silver flask, about 6 inches by 4 inches. He unscrews its cap and pours a splash into its coffee. He turns and offers me the flask. "Little hair for your monkey." No, thank you. He raises his eyebrows, as though surprised that I have declined. "All right, well, reckon I better have yours." He dumps another splash into his cup, caps his flask, and slips it back into his boot. He sips his cup of coffee, liquor, and nods toward my luggage. "Where are you headed?" "Boston." "Boston? That's goddamn Yankee land, ain't it?" I smile. "That's my home." "Oh, goddamn. Where is Boston, anyway?" "It's in Massachusetts." He stares at me blankly. "You know," I say, "New England." He keeps staring at me. Bam, he slaps the counter. "God damn it, that's it." "What?" "I've been sitting here trying to figure out who you remind me of, and by God, I just did. It's old what's-his-face, that movie actor from back in the old days. You look just like the sumbitch." He snaps his fingers again. "Oh, hell, you know who I'm talking about." I do know who he's talking about. Ever since I was about 15, people have told me I look like Montgomery Clift, the Hollywood star of the 50s. And I guess it's true. My eyes are blue and I have big eyebrows like his, and my hair's brown and pretty thick. I know in a way it's a plus. I do get a lot of compliments on my headshots, but still, sometimes I get tired of hearing it. Anyway, rather than help Merle put a name to the face he has in his mind, I shrug and play dumb. "God damn it," he says. He puts his hand on top of my head and turns my face so that I'm looking down to the end of the counter where Faye is stooped over, adding a check. "Hey, Faye," he points to my face with his other hand. "Who's this kid look like? You know, that old movie actor." Faye looks up from her calculations, chews her gum, and ponders my face. She smiles. "Montgomery Clift. He looks like Montgomery Clift." Bam! Merle slaps the counter. "By God, that's it. Montgomery Clift. You look just like the sumbitch." He sips his coffee, liquor, and stares at me again. I'll be damned. Faye refills our cups, then brings out her order tablet and grabs the pen behind her ear. "Want your usual, Merle?" "All right. Why not? Ain't had it since yesterday." She writes down Merle's usual, flips the sheet over, and looks at me. "How about you, handsome? What can I get you?" Nothing to eat, thank you, just coffee." She nods, tears off Merle's order, and puts it in the window to the kitchen. As she hurries away with the coffee pot, Merle brings out his flask and dumps another splash in his coffee. I look back out the windows. The sky over the bus terminal across the street has lightened to a soft gray. The wind gusts and swirls clouds of dust past the window. Merle sips his coffee, liquor, and sets down his cup. "How old are you, son?" 21. "God almighty, 21. What I wouldn't give to be 21 again. Did you go to college?"
"Yeah."
"Whereabouts?"
"Harvard."
"Harvard? God damn, you must be sharper than a snake's ass." I laugh.
"No. Actually, I got in because my father teaches there. They had to let me in."
"Your daddy teaches at Harvard?"
"Yeah."
"Oh, what's he teach?"
"Math."
"Math? Crap fire, I bet he's a smart son of a bitch."
"Well, he's a son of a bitch. But other than that, I..."
Merle laughs and slaps my back. "I like you, Harvard. I like to hear you talk."
Faye sets a large oval-shaped platter of greasy food in front of Merle. 3 fried eggs with bright yellow yolks, an enormous round sausage patty, fried potatoes, and 2 biscuits. My stomach growls. I haven't eaten since yesterday in Albuquerque. Merle cuts into his sausage and takes a bite. Yep, boys and daddies are funny. You never know how it's going to turn out. I got a boy about your age, be 20 in June.
Oh, what does he do?
Ah, he's in the pen right now.
Oh, sorry.
Merle saws off a flimsy strip of yolk dripping egg and forks it into his mouth. No, never could do nothing with him. Hard-headedest some bitch you ever saw. Ran off down there to Houston to live with his mom and started snorting that cocaine. They finally caught him with a sack full of it.
God, that's terrible.
Yep. He sets down his fork and sips his coffee, liquor. So, you're on your way home to Boston?
Yeah.
Where you coming from?
California.
California? Good God, what you doing out here? Ain't nothing but prune pickers and prick lickers out here.
I laugh. Well, actually I was trying to find a job.
What sort of job?
Acting. I'm an actor. Or at least I wanted to be. I'm still a stage actor, sort of. Anyway, I was trying to get in the movies.
I'll be damned. Hey, Faye!
Faye turns from the coffee machine. Murrow points to me.
Albert here's a movie actor.
No, I say, I didn't say that. Merle ignores me, and Faye, chopping her gum, walks along the counter to us. She smiles.
Really? What were you in? Maybe I seen you.
I wasn't in anything. That's sort of the whole point. I bombed out. I'm going home.
Oh, well, bless your heart.
Faye walks back to the coffee machine. Merle chews a bite of biscuit and looks at me.
You bombed out, he says.
Yeah.
What the hell's that mean?
It means I couldn't get a job, so I'm going back home. He stares at me and blinks his eyes like he doesn't understand.
Hell, maybe you just didn't fight hard enough.
No, I fought. Believe me, it's just an extremely...
What's the matter, boy? You hungry?
Excuse me. Without realizing it, I'm ogling Merle's food. I look away.
You look hungry, boy. What's going on? You out of money?
No. Actually, I just, hadn't thought to order yet.
You're lying, ain't you? Faye, bring Harvard here one of my specials on me.
No, really, I say. I couldn't accept that.
The hell you couldn't, he says.
He continues to eat, and in a few minutes, Faye serves me a heaping sausage and egg breakfast just like his.
There you go, son, he says. Get after it.
Thank you, Merle. Thank you very much.
Yep.
He shovels a fork full of potatoes into his mouth. I begin devouring my breakfast.
So, Merle says, what'd you do? Get on the bus without no money?
I pause as I chew a bite of sausage. I decide this is a good chance to rehearse my robbery routine for my parents. Actually, I was robbed. He looks at me.
Robbed? When?
Last night. On the bus just west of here.
Who the hell robbed you?
It was a gang.
A gang?
Yeah. There were about 8 of them. Young Hispanic guys.
God damn, how much they get off you?
About $100. He whistles.
I'll be damned.
I poke a piece of biscuit in my mouth and nod woefully. Yeah, it was pretty bad. He plucks a paper napkin from the stainless steel dispenser on the counter and wipes his mouth.
Harvard, I hate to do it, but I'm gonna call bullshit on you.
Pardon me?
You're lying. I've been robbed a time or two, and you don't act a damn thing like a fella's been robbed. What happened? Did you take off broke?
I stare down at my food. I lost my money playing poker on the bus. Then I got pissed off and got off the bus. Merle roars with laughter and slaps the counter.
Ha ha! God damn, I love it. Harvard, you're all right.
He sips his coffee, liquor.
So what are you gonna do now, boy? Ass up stranded in Abilene, Texas.
I don't know. I guess I'll call my parents and tell them I've lost my money. My dad's gonna kill me. Dread shoots through me as I imagine Dad's wrath. Merle takes a bite of sausage and sips his coffee, liquor.
However, tell you what I'll do. I could use a hand right now. One of my crew broke his arm in a bar fight and can't work. I'll give you a job and a place to stay for a week or two till you get your feet back under you. Then you can shag ass on home with some money in your pocket.
What kind of job?
Roughnecking on one of my rigs. I know you ain't got no experience, but I'll go on and start you at $8 an hour. Hell, that's about 65 a day. In a week's time, you ought to hair up and heal over pretty good, don't you reckon?
Yes.
Well, you interested?
I'm stunned by the abruptness of his proposal, but even this unknown seems better than enduring Dad's scorn. Besides, what an adventure. Roughnecking in Texas.
Wow.
Yes, I'm interested.
Good, Merle says. Got us a deal, then.
He eats a bite of egg and sips his coffee, liquor.
Excuse me, I say, but what is your name?
He sets down his cup and holds out his hand.
Lusky. Merle Lusky.
3. Trudging into the wind, I follow Merle up the street to a huge red pickup truck with a four-door cab and ridiculously large tires, especially at the back, which has two tires on each side and big bulbous fenders to accommodate them. The truck also has shiny chrome wheels and bumpers, a chrome grille guard on its front, yellow running lights above its windshield, and along its wide fenders and sprouting from the roof, a long antenna wobbling in the wind. Holding down his hat with one hand, Merle opens the back seat door, takes my suitcase and backpack, and tosses them into the truck. He slams the door and points over the truck to the passenger side.
Get in.
I go around and wrestle with the door, wedging my body against it to hold it open against the wind. Finally, I pull myself up into the cab. The door closes with the force of the wind, leaving Merle and me in quiet stillness.
Man, this wind is amazing.
Oh, hell, this is just a breeze.
He reaches behind his seat and brings up a big half-gallon bottle of Jack Daniel's Old Number 7 Tennessee whiskey. He raises his eyebrows as though surprised.
I'll be damned. Brand new bottle.
He unscrews the cap, pushes back his hat, and takes a sip. Grimacing and pursing his lips, he wipes his mouth with the back of his hand.
Oh, yeah, he says. He holds the bottle out to me. Here you go, boy, get you a sip.
I stare at the bottle. I'm not exactly opposed to catching a buzz, although I rarely drink the hard stuff, but the crack of dawn seems like a fucked up time to do it.
Come on now, he says. He wags the bottle. Get you a little taste.
Gosh, Merle. I don't know, it's sort of early, isn't it?
Oh, goddamn, Harvard.
He points to the digital clock on the dash. It reads 6:19.
Tell you what, you draw and pay right now. As of 6 o'clock, I'm paying your ass $8 an hour.
He knits his eyebrows and scowls.
Now, by God, I'm tired of drinking alone. Have some whiskey, dammit.
He shoves the bottle at me. Although it seems an incredibly morbid thing to ask of someone, I guess I can't very well refuse a direct order from my new employer. I take the huge bottle and drink. The warm whiskey burns my throat, but I clench my teeth and swallow. I offer to return Merle his bottle. He won't take it.
Go on, he says. Get you another. And goddammit, don't play with it. Drink the sumbitch.
I nod. With Merle carefully monitoring my performance, I gulp a generous swig. I cough and shudder. He smiles.
What's the matter, boy? Don't you know good whiskey when you see it?
He grabs the bottle and tosses back another swig. Merle drives through a wide street lined with crumbling red brick and rusty tin-roofed industrial buildings. Their signs, painted on front windows or suspended from poles along the road, advertise tire repair, oil field supplies, veterinarian supplies, agricultural seed and fertilizer, tractors, propane, and hardware. A mile or so beyond the last businesses, the pavement and chain-link fences give way to red soil farm plots bordered by barbed wire fences. I turn and look back at the town. The ground is so flat it's hard to see much. A thin band of green treetops, scattered steeples of churches, and rising.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?